new government report on climate change shows us what may be in store for Florida. Good Wednesday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the National Climate Assessment, Florida, rising seas, and a warming world. It's not a good mix. We want your calls now at 549-2937. Then later, Teach for America is celebrating its 10th anniversary in Jacksonville this month. How has TFA changed Duval classrooms? Plus, Art Republic with an exciting new program for regional artists. A huge opportunity if you are a budding artist. We'll tell you about that too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, some climate news. On Monday, more than 300 members of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences signed a statement. It calls for the federal government to maintain scientific content on publicly accessible websites, to appoint qualified personnel to positions requiring scientific expertise, to cease censorship and intimidation of government scientists, and to reverse the decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord. The Trump administration, of course, has initiated the process of U.S. withdrawal from that landmark Paris Agreement and continues to cast doubt on the seriousness of human-caused climate change. Now, scientists are pointing to the U.S. National Climate Assessment Report for people interested in studying these complex issues. The full report is expected later this year, and it's expected to actually go beyond last year's report, looking at climate change within specific U.S. communities and industries. As we anticipate that report being released, a new study out in Science Magazine shows that Florida and Texas are the two states expected to suffer the greatest economic damage from climate change. Impacts ranging from hurricanes to storm surges, changes to agriculture, changes in mortality rates, rising sea levels, even rising crime rates. There's a lot to talk about here. We're going to begin the hour as we welcome Dr. Peter Ward. He's a geophysicist who spent decades with the U.S. Geological Survey. And his theory of ozone depletion contributing to climate change differs from other prevailing theories looking at CO2, carbon, as the primary cause of our warming world. Ward is also the author of the new book, What Really Causes Global Warming, Greenhouse Gases or Ozone Depletion. He's on the line now with more about the upcoming climate report and offering his thoughts. Dr. Peter Ward, thanks for joining the show.
Good morning, Melissa. Pleasure to be here.
And as we talk about the new climate assessment report that's expected later this year, what are your questions and comments? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Now, Peter Ward, in a moment, we'll talk about your theory in your book. But first, let me get your thoughts about the report expected later this year that sounds the alarm yet again about the perils inherent in climate change. And in particular, it looks at specific U.S. communities, parts of the country, and specific industries. What can you share with us about what we know so far that's going to be released in this report?
Well, we should point out, first of all, that this is the fourth national assessment that Congress required scientists in the federal government every few years to turn out a new assessment of climate. The first half of the report came out in November of last year, and it talked about the science, about what we know about what scientists agree think is happening in terms of global warming. The report that's due out later this year carries that scientific information into specific communities and talks about across the country how different communities are likely to be affected. Now, for Florida, a big issue is sea level rise. And much of the major damage predicted for Florida and Texas and even parts of Central California relate to sea level rise. One of the big issues is whether the sea level is going to continue to rise at the rates that scientists are currently thinking. And this is where there is a difference of coming out now in the science.
And doesn't the difference relate to whether melting of ice turns out to be fast or slow, and whether or not in particular a huge chunk of the West Antarctic ice sheet, the rate of melt of that piece of ice down at the bottom of the world? Aren't scientists watching that pretty closely right now, Doctor?
Well, the big issue is climate is changing. We've seen a significant change in climate since 1970. And when we look back over a longer period of time, we think it even goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Throughout geologic time, we see huge changes in climate. So the climate is changing. The question is, what is causing that change and what we can do about it? Currently, the thought is that most scientists that greenhouse gases are causing that change based on their understanding of greenhouse gases and the climate models. They predict that in 10, 20, 30, 40 years, there's going to be significantly more warming than now. And that is the problem. But what we're worried about in the long term is the big issue, not so much of what's been happening just in the last decade or two. This is where there now appears to be a fundamental change in thinking that is difficult to communicate.
And, of course, scientists have been banding together trying to sound the alarm about this for a number of years. This is such a partisan issue, though. People tend to see this problem through their political prism. That's something I know that concerns the scientific community. At the same time, while we await this report from the government, the new study that's actually out just this morning is really of concern, I think, for everybody that lives in Florida. This new research showing, again, that Florida and Texas are the two states expected to suffer the greatest economic damage from a changing climate. Researchers are calculating that Florida will lose $100 billion from GDP due to climate change, the worst economic hit to any state in the country. And as you pointed out, a lot of this is going to be due to rising seas around our thousands of miles of coast. And so as we look at this data coming out, and at the same time we see the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, what seems to be happening, Doctor, is private industry and other players are sort of filling the gap now that the government is pulling away from this. For example, the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, says he's going to donate millions to the UN Climate Change Secretariat to help countries implement these commitments. Companies are now including climate change risk in their financial reporting. The business community seems to be moving ahead in this space, ahead of government. And how encouraging is that for you?
Well, the big issue is how we use science to develop good public policy. What's the best science available for developing good public policy? Unfortunately, the science is changing, and this is in an environment where there has been great partisan arguing and bickering, and that makes it even more complicated. So we're left with the fact that the science is changing, but even the scientists aren't willing to accept that. The fundamental report that came out in 2017 came to two fundamental conclusions, stated right away in the first part of the executive summary. One is that global warming is primarily caused by greenhouse gases. And two is that there's no convincing alternative explanation. Now, I've gone after the authors of this report and explained to them that there, both of those conclusions could be wrong. And we really need to look at the new evidence for the fact that greenhouse gases do not absorb enough heat to actually be the cause of global warming.
And let me just jump in and say that you posit that the real problem is ozone depletion, which allows more UV ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface. Your theory runs counter to the overwhelming scientific consensus on this, which is looking more at CO2 emissions, right?
You're absolutely correct, but science is not done by consensus. Science is not done by popular vote. Science is done by evidence. and by developing of the data that show what is happening in the world. And unfortunately, over the last couple of hundred years, the idea of greenhouse gases being the cause has gotten stronger and stronger. In 1988, the IPCC was founded not for the purpose of determining what's causing global warming. It was founded for the purpose of developing consensus behind greenhouse warming theory so that political leaders would take the expensive steps necessary to reduce global warming. Now it's turning out that we have a fundamental misunderstanding in science about heat, about what it is that causes things to get warmer. And unfortunately, what this is showing is that greenhouse gases are not the cause of global warming and physically cannot be the cause.
And again, I realize you've well researched this, but and I'm curious to hear your theories about this. But when I research your work, you are described by your detractors as a climate skeptic who is debunking well-researched evidence over a period of decades. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not a climate skeptic. I believe in climate change. It's very clear the climate has been changing. In 2006, I discovered a fundamental enigma in climate science, and I set out to try to figure out what's going on. Being retired, I've been able to work full-time, round the clock, on this now for almost 12 years. And as I dug deeper and deeper, I discovered there was a fundamental mistake in how we calculate energy. And this goes back a couple hundred years, and it is a mistake in physics and in climate change. Needless to say, when you discover a fundamental mistake, the first thing is scientists want to dismiss you as being a skeptic or as being not knowing what's going on or being in the pay of some company that wants to prove something different. That's not the case in my case. I have been looking at the science very, very carefully, and I have written several papers on it. I am talking to a number of the top scientists around the world. What most of them say is, there's just no way you could be right and the rest of us are wrong.
Okay, let's go
but
to some calls.
Yeah.
And let me just go to some calls now. 549-2937. Hazel in St. Augustine. Hi, Hazel.
Hi, good morning. Well, I would certainly agree with your speaker that the climate is changing. But where we come from, the research that we do, I have been a science policy advisor in Washington, D.C., to the National Science Foundation, the National Academy of Engineering, the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment. And we saw the CO2 rising back in the 1980s. And at the point of our research, we have a new report coming out on Friday in our Green Transition Scoreboard. And what we decided is that the transition from fossil fuels to renewable sources of energy is a basically evolutionary technology. And just as we went from whale oil and coal and wood to petroleum, we are now transitioning from those kind of fossil fuels that you dig out of the ground to capturing the photons, the free photons from the sun, which actually drive all of the processes on this planet. So we decided instead to track the private investments going into solar, wind, energy efficiency, electric vehicles, electric vehicle chargers, LED lighting, all of the new technological wave which are going to provide the jobs of the future. And our report, I can announce this first on your program because it's coming out on Friday, our new total of private investments in green sector technologies around the world is $9.3 trillion with a T. And that's cumulatively, we've been tracking this since 2007. So our point is, give or whatever the scientific arguments are, this evolutionary change is now backed by trillions of dollars of private investment and is happening because it's the next evolutionary technology step.
Right. And Hazel, it's so good to have you call into the show. You've appeared on this program before. This is a burgeoning business that is growing like wildfire around the world. And Dr. Ward, as we talk about this, I realize that you differ from many of your scientific colleagues on theories about climate change. But certainly Hazel is right in that private industry is looking at a number of innovative ways to increase sustainability, deal with the effects of a warming planet, and they're racing ahead of municipalities. They're going after this market. Carbon capture and storage, I think Hazel mentioned that, is one aspect of many. So what about that that whole piece of this, that amidst these very serious reports coming out, the private sector is really stepping up?
Well, it's renewable energy is very important. I mean, fossil fuels, we're going to run out of fossil fuels in 100, 200 years. There's not much question about it. And the result of greenhouse theory leading to development of renewable energy sources is a great, great effort. And it's wonderful to see industry going after that effort. Well, we still need to step back and say, what is causing the warming that we've observed? And more important is, what does this mean 20, 30 years from now in terms of the risk that we face? And what can we do about it now to make a difference? What my research shows, and it is in disagreement with most established scientists, is that greenhouse gases cannot physically be the cause of the warming that we've observed.
And what do you say, and as I've researched your work, what do you say to your critics who they've called you, frankly, they've been pretty mean. They've called you names, they've called you a crank, they've said that what you're putting out is garbage, that you're wrong, basically. What do you say to those critics?
Well, first of all, most of those critics are people fomenting on the internet, not scientists. I have a very good relationship. I was a government scientist for 27 years. I chaired a committee at the White House. I worked on a committee for Vice President Gore. I led a major national program, developed a major national program. I have a strong resume in science, in doing science. And what I've been able to do over the last 12 years is to pursue my intuition and science directly without any obligations to anybody. And for a long time, I was very concerned about greenhouse gases. But what I've discovered is that greenhouse gases do not absorb heat. They just absorb a few spectral lines of energy, and that's not enough to cause the warming.
Okay. One second, Dr. Ward, because we have so many other people waiting on hold. Hazel, we'd like to have you back on the program to talk about your report when you're free, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, Hazel. Thanks for that call. Rhea is in Palatka. Go ahead, Rhea.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to make a special request to all of the good people who sit in their cars with the engines running and the air conditioner going. And I wanted to say, if you have more than 5 minutes, could you please turn off your engine and go inside? Because that's my pet peeve. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thanks for that. Wayne is on the line. Wayne in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Wayne.
Hi. I would like to understand what Dr. Ward's position is on radiant versus reflective energy. I'm not entirely confident that greenhouse gases are not contributing, right, literally by virtue of the expression greenhouse, in terms of reflective energy, right, on the airborne particulate that is represented by the greenhouse gases. I recognize that and support the comment that the depletion of the ozone layer increases the amount of radiant absorption that we're receiving on the Earth. But I would like to better understand, right, I would posit that greenhouse gases are also an accelerant to the process. And I would like to understand that science. And I totally agree that internet comments do not form opinion, that opinion must be based in science.
Yeah, so thank you, Wayne. Yeah, excellent questions from you, Wayne. Thank you. So, Dr. Ward, is it possible that you're not wrong, but that other climate scientists are also not wrong, that these are both drivers of warming overall around the planet over a long period of time?
Well, what we all know is that we get warmer by radiation from a warmer body. It turns out you cannot get warmer by radiation from yourself. A body cannot get warmer based on radiation from itself. What we're talking about in greenhouse gas theory is that radiation from Earth is warming Earth. What warms Earth is the sun. We all know that. We go out in the sunlight during the day, we get hot. We can even get sunburned. Current climate models effectively calculate that if you're standing outside at night, you're being warmed more by the infrared coming up from the Earth than if you're standing outside during the day from the sun. We know that's wrong. We all, from personal experience, know we get hotter with radiation from a hotter body. It takes the hotter body of sun to warm Earth.
Let's go to Tom in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was just going to say, how do we know this is not just a natural process? One extraterrestrial hit on the Earth from an asteroid or a supervolcano can certainly cause cooling again. How do we know that? And there's been many ice ages that have gone away. So how do we know what caused that?
Well, this is a very good question. I'm an Earth scientist. I know the history of the Earth quite well. And what I've discovered is that ozone depletion is caused not only by CFC gases that humans produced in the 1960s and 1970s, but it's also caused by chlorine and bromine emitted by basaltic-type volcanoes, large flows of basalt, like we see in central Idaho or what cover Iceland. And throughout geologic history, we find that whenever these flows of basalt were large, those were times of major warming, major mass extinction, major ocean acidification. The largest of these was 251 million years ago, when lava covered an area of Siberia equivalent to all of the United States, less Texas and Montana.
Okay.
Just imagine lava flows going all the way across the country.
And let me ask you as a follow-up, for example, the website climatecentral.org tries to answer this question from the caller saying that, people say, well, how do we know that this isn't a natural cycle? Burning coal, oil, and gas release heat-trapping CO2. And beginning with the measurements in the 1950s, those levels have been climbing, and they rule out actually the most obvious natural suspect, the sun, which is more what you were saying. And I'm quoting here, the amount of heat it sends to the Earth varies, but it would not take much brightening to cause the increase in temperature we've seen. Satellites have been monitoring the sun since the 1970s, when the fastest warming has been taking place, and the brightening is just not there. Debunking what you're saying.
Well, the difference is the question of the radiation from the sun, how does it get through to Earth? And the role that the ozone layer plays here is that the ozone layer absorbs ultraviolet B, which is the hottest energy from the sun. It's what causes sunburn, cataracts, skin cancer, and mutations. And the ultraviolet B, since 1970, more of it has been reaching the Earth. We observe that. And the result of this is because the ozone layer has been depleted. Less of that energy is being absorbed at the ozone layer. So the ozone layer acts like Venetian blinds. And it allows more of this very hot radiation from the sun, or less of it. And that's what's causing the change.
Okay.
That's not the way climate scientists currently think about energy from the sun.
Well, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us, and we'll anticipate the new report in the fall and also the report coming out of the Green Scorecard in St. Johns County next week. Geophysicist Dr. Peter Ward, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later. Art Republic is coming back to downtown Jacksonville this fall with those amazing large-scale murals. But right now, they're also announcing a new program to develop new artistic talent. We'll tell you about that later. But up next, Teach for America is marking its 10th anniversary in local classrooms. What's been the impact? A closer look next.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
The 2018 Players' Championship returns May 8th through 13th. Witness the competition drama unfold on the Island Green. Enjoy the beer garden presented by Hoptinger with friends or watch country artist Luke Combs perform during Military Appreciation Day on Tuesday, May 8th. Tickets at theplayers.com.
I'm Rick Mullaney, director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for WJCT's quarterly program, Policy Matters. On each installment, we look at how public policy affects our lives. On our next program, we are very pleased to have Adam Putnam, who is running for governor of the state of Florida and is the commissioner of agriculture for the state. That's on the next Policy Matters, Wednesday evening, 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 5th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Welcome back. Well, Teach for America is marking its 10th anniversary in Jacksonville this month. TFA is a national organization that recruits and places young teachers in the nation's most underserved schools. These young teachers make a 2-year commitment to teach in the classroom and work with the school faculty. Here in Jacksonville, the alumni network of this group is now approaching 200 people. So what's been the impact of Teach for America here in our area? Here with more, we welcome John Grab. He's manager of new teacher development with Teach for America here in town. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also an alumni who has taught in the classroom. Another alumni is, or alumna, I should say, is Lynette Jean. She's associate director of programs at Common Threads. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And it's 549-2937 as we talk about Teach for America. Okay, John Grab, let's begin with you. You taught for TFA. Now you're managing new teacher development for the organization here in Jacksonville as you mark 10 years in Duval County. Take us from the beginning to right now. How TFA has grown in this community.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It is our 10-year anniversary. So 10 years ago in 2008, we started here with just a handful of teachers, almost 30, right? And now 10 years later, you mentioned earlier, over 200 alum. If you add the current core of 100 teachers, that's over 300 teachers and teacher leaders right now within Duval County Public Schools, working every day with students, for students, partnering with the district. Within that 10 years, I think we've seen a lot of victories with our people. We have over 90% stay within education here in Duval County. We have teachers who are in classrooms right now. We have assistant principals. We have some of the numbers we have here. In the past 10 years, we have 49 winners for Teacher of the Year, including this past year, Stephanie Bellino, who is the overall district County Teacher of the Year in just her third year teaching. We have built some strong partnerships with the district. We've really worked on that. Recent RAND survey we gave principals, over 90% said the Teach for America core members added positively to students' classrooms and the school culture.
And that's certainly the intent, of course, particularly TFA's commitment to going into the most underserved schools in the country. And we see that here in Duval County. Let me ask you, at the same time, teachers are in crisis right now in America. Teachers in several states over the last month or two, Kentucky, Arizona, West Virginia, and Oklahoma, they've gone on strike. They've taken to the streets because they are really having a very hard time making a living as teachers. They haven't had raises in many, many years. It's been difficult to recruit people to teach in the nation's public schools. That's also affecting Teach for America. You're having to struggle to recruit qualified young people to teach because there's certainly a strong perception that they can't afford to do it. So how do you address that? Because as a nation, we are not valuing this profession. And so we're now seeing the effects of that.
Yeah, it's, I think one thing that reminds me of is that there's more that unites us than divides us. I think we think about that often. You know, there's a video that I watch occasionally. I think his name is Taylor Mahi, and it's What Do Teachers Make? And it's Teachers Make a Difference. And I think that's something we think about a lot. And I think it's a story of two tales. I think outside the classroom, that is a perception, that is a reality. But at the same time, the schools that we're in every single day, that number I mentioned earlier about over 90% of principals, there are a lot of people who care in this room, in this city, that care a lot about education, care a lot about students in schools. Mm-hmm. And that's not any different with us. That's why we're here. We add to that recruitment. We add to that development to make lifelong advocates for students in education.
Now, one of those advocates is you, Lynette Jean. You taught with TFA and you're now Associate Director of Programs at Common Threads. We'll talk about Common Threads in a moment. But first, what was your experience like teaching for Teach for America?
That's an excellent question, Melissa. So I was a core member in 2012 for Teach for America Jacksonville. I taught at First Coast High School, and my experience was incredible. My students were everything. They were at the center of everything. I learned to really connect with our city, learn to understand Jacksonville, my classroom, my students. And so one of the great things in my classroom is I was able to have the opportunity to create a safe space for my kids and really build relationships and learn what was it that they needed? What did they want to improve on? And where did they want to grow so they can continue making Jacksonville the best city they live in, to be agents of change for their community, as well as in our four walls of our classroom.
What were some of the biggest problems your kids had?
So in my classroom, I did notice that my students were from situations that were very vulnerable, limited access. And so one of the biggest things is, and especially teaching Spanish, you really dive into the culture and the food. And so what we ended up doing was creating an after-school program for our students to be safe, as well as to really dive into our culture and try the different cuisines. And so something that we did is open that opportunity up for our kids to have that conversation about how does it connect to what they are doing at home with their families, and then how does it connect back to what's different and how can I kind of absorb that information and really get to know what's out there and the opportunities that I have.
Now, you went from your experience with Teach for America to Common Threads. That's an organization that offers cooking and nutrition programs to prevent childhood obesity. And counterintuitively, kids growing up in a poor household tend to be more overweight often, which people don't really understand. But that's a big issue that you're working on, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. So there have been instances where our students just don't have access, especially working on the northwest side of Jacksonville. You're seeing food deserts. You're seeing there's limited access for our students. And so they would come to class hungry, and it makes it difficult to really learn, to really absorb the information and want to participate. And so Common Threads is an amazing organization that provides and delivers that culturally relevant cooking and nutrition programming to prevent childhood obesity, but also create agents of change to empower their communities, to empower the classroom, and just be models for their families, because we are in our second generation of non-cookers. And so to be able to bring kids back to the kitchen.
Non-cookers.
Yeah. So to bring kids and families back to the kitchen and build a culture around food and healthy lifestyles.
Right. A whole generation of kids growing up not knowing how to cook. Do they still teach home ec in high school?
Does it depend on the school?
It depends on the school.
Okay. Mm-hmm. 16 million children are hungry in this country. One third of them are overweight or obese, as Lynette knows. They're at higher risk for asthma, heart disease, diabetes, all of the horrible diseases that can come with that. So, okay. So as Lynette has moved on to doing a different kind of work, tell me a little bit about what the typical path is for a TFA alum, John. You know, so most people commit to 2 years and then they go on to do something else. You've stayed with the organization.
Absolutely.
But more often, young people teach, they get a lot of experience doing that. It's very fulfilling, but they don't always stay in the classroom. Mm-hmm. That gets at my earlier point, which is that there's a crisis in the teaching profession overall. Teach for America has tried to come in and address that with getting these two-year commitments, mm-hmm. but it can be very difficult to get teachers mm-hmm. to stay beyond that, right?
Yeah, and I think that's why partnerships like Teach for America are so important, because that is what we care about. I'd also want to mention, I think perception is reality for everyone. I think the perception you mentioned, like the two-year commitment, that's not really how we internally. I think if there's one perception I wish I could shift, it's that this is a two-year in and out. That's just not the case. We do have over 90% remain in education. I think about, you know, Chelsea Matthews, who was a 2010 Jacksonville native. She's now the assistant principal at Butler Young Women's Leadership Academy. I think about Willie Brewster, 2012 with me and Lynette, who came in. He's now an assistant principal at Andrew Robinson. Mm-hmm. I think about Stephanie Bellino, who's still in the classroom, right? So we have these strands. We have these teachers that stay in the classroom. We have over 300 teachers and leaders in classrooms now that haven't left. And additionally, we have, you know, I think we could all agree that there are more factors outside the classroom that impact a student inside the classroom, and that's what Lynette's doing. Lynette's working with students in classrooms, but in a way that supports the teacher and the whole child.
What's your imperative then to continue this program in Jacksonville? What are your biggest challenges and goals? I'm quoting here from a report at NBC News. Because of the challenges to education, the overall number of TFA educators has dropped from over 6,000 around the country to about half that last year. So you're challenged in trying to grow this program and recruit really good young people. Mm-hmm. How are you addressing that?
I think you mentioned it earlier. It is a bigger issue that I think impacts us. It impacts the school board. You know, school boards had to make really tough decisions. We are United with them, CARE with them. We are DCPS. But they've had to make tough decisions, and we've been a part of that. And so
they're cutting $62 million out of the budget this
right,
year.
Exactly. And it's tough. And I think that's why it's even more imperative that we have these organizations that stay. I know I just got an email the other day, we hit our recruiting goal for this year for Teach for America. I know we have 40 new teachers coming in this year on top of the 50 we have right now in the core, which will put us over 350 next year and over 500 within the next 3 years. I think speaking to your question about the challenges, I think the first challenge is that the talent, kind of what you were speaking to, Lynette, talent mm-hmm. is equally distributed across lines of race and class, but opportunity is not. That hasn't changed. That's not going anywhere. That's why we're here. That's what we address. And then two, I think was the exciting mm-hmm. challenge, and this is where I'll kind of tie it together, is that we only started with 30, right? And now we're over 350 come next year. And that's a challenge, because how do we leverage, how do we utilize, how do we mobilize these partnerships we have to truly make a difference in the students and communities that we care about so much?
And Teach for America, as you just pointed out, was founded to dismantle educational inequity, to mm-hmm. to level the playing field for kids no matter their background. What was that experience like for you in the classroom, Lynette? What are the most important observations you could share now with all of our listeners about some of the really, the structural inequalities that we see in public education that really affect kids in the schools greatly?
So I think something to keep in mind, especially in education, it's important to build those relationships with your students. So in being in Jacksonville for the last 6 years, it's become my home. I've gone to birthday parties, baptisms, picnics, sporting events for my students. And so being able to be embedded in the community is what creates that change in that one day that we want to achieve through Teach for America. And we try and create leaders and expose our students to all of the different people in our community that are empowering and having this kind of change and these opportunities available for kids. Mm-hmm. So I think with our work here, we're developing leaders to drive the changes we need to see in education. You're seeing it across the various sectors, whether you work in nonprofit, whether you work at the district, whether you work in a corporate environment. But these changes are what's going to shape these opportunities that are most important for our most vulnerable students and the communities that we serve.
As you celebrate this anniversary, how can people listening learn more? You want to recruit more people. So how do you go about doing that?
Thank you for that. I'll actually do a quick plug. We have a May 5th coming up. It's at Lee High School. It's our annual student showcase. I think that's a great opportunity, a great way to see our work in action. We're going to have over 100 teachers there, over 100 students and families. We're going to have with the Woodland Acres step team come out, the elementary step team. They're going to be so great. I think that's a great way to come out and learn. We have quarterly conferences for professional development for teachers. That's another way to plug in. So I would just invite even you, Melissa, if you want to come out, personal invitation, May 5th, Saturday, come on out and join us.
Thanks for that. Now, when you recruit kids, or I shouldn't say kids, young adults to teach in Jacksonville with Teach for America, what schools do they tend to go to? Where are they teaching?
As you mentioned earlier, it's educational equity, right? That's the mission. That's the goal, specifically with Title I schools. So that would be communities with unique socioeconomic barriers. I think we strongly believe that great teachers make a difference and that there is talent. There is hard. There's a lot of brilliance in the classrooms. Every time I walk in classrooms, I'm in classrooms every single day with teachers. I walk in and I'm inspired. I think of Tremont Thomas at Rebalt. I think of Jeremiah Tisby at Northwestern. These students work so hard, care so much about their education, but perception is reality for a lot of people, and they don't see that, they don't believe that. So I think we want to communicate that. Number one, I forgot your question. What was
that? Where are the Teach for America teachers placed?
Thank you. Where they're placed. So yes.
Yeah.
So those classrooms, the classrooms with those unique socioeconomic barriers, in order to connect those students who care so much. To the resources they need to be successful.
So is it primarily in high schools, middle schools?
Okay.
Which schools?
So elementary, middle, high school right
all
now.
All schools.
Yeah, right now I have, I think we're in 8 high schools.
Which high schools?
Rebalt, Raines, First Coast, Edwight, and then to name a couple middle schools, Northwestern, Young Men's, Young Women's Leadership Academy, formerly Butler, Gilbert, Woodland Acres Elementary, Arlington Elementary, Garden City with Principal Glover.
Across the city.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the big event is coming up May 5th, Lee High School, as Teach for America celebrates 10 years in Jacksonville, Duval County. Teach for America has teachers in its core in schools across the country, the most underserved schools in America. And so kudos to you both, and thank you both so much for joining us to share this with us.
Thanks for having us,
thank
Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
John Grab is Manager of New Teacher Development with Teach for America. Lynette Jean is an alumna of TFA, and she's Associate Director of Programs at Common Threads. A quick break, and in a moment, the work of Art Republic. You've seen those massive eye-catching murals around downtown. We'll find out what they're up to next as they support new talent. You're going to want to hear about this. It's right after this break.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com. The 2018 Players' Championship returns May 8th through 13th. Witness the competition drama unfold on the Island Green. Enjoy the beer garden presented by Hoptinger with friends or watch country artist Luke Combs perform during Military Appreciation Day on Tuesday, May 8th. Tickets at theplayers.com.
A pattern of sexual assault against immigration detainees by those charged with protecting them.
59% of the allegations identify an officer, so that's an ICE staffer or a contractor, as the alleged perpetrator.
Investigating rampant abuse in ICE detention centers, that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Golf is doing all it can to keep up.
5 years ago, when you came to a PGA Tour tournament, we didn't allow you to bring your cell phone on site.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How to make golf great again. We'll have that story for you. Also, the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
When you call 911, what do you hope will happen?
Police, Operator 363, how may I help you?
Hi, I have two gentlemen at my cafe that are refusing to make a purchase or leave.
I'm John Donvan. When you see something, you should say something, but what actually warrants a call to the police? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's an exciting new opportunity for artists. Art Republic here in the city is already renowned for its incredible large-scale murals that have gone up all around downtown Jacksonville. You've seen them. Well, now the organization is launching something new, a regional artist development program. They're going to choose a select group of artists from a variety of mediums to take part in a year-long program with lots of goodies, travel, workshops, mentorship, and more. Some of the winners will be announced this fall when Art Republic puts on its third annual event with even more exciting public art. Jessica Santiago is the founder and director of Art Republic, and she's here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm such a fan. You're always up to something exciting, and this is something that you're launching just this week. Tell me about it.
It's really exciting. It's a really great milestone. It has been in the works since the very beginning of releasing Art Republic. We saw the need for our local community to really be poured into in a dynamic way. We really saw that, you know, the lectures and, you know, understanding how to build a website is helpful, but we really needed something that was transformational. So I went to work on looking at what's really affected me, and it's, you know, traveling and meeting new people and building the network and learning from other artists is what's given me the stamina to continue to build Art Republic. So it just made sense to be able to give that as a gift to our local artists.
This is going to be an artist development program. Mm-hmm. You're soliciting bids from regional artists, and it'll be a life-changing experience, it sounds like. What will the winners receive?
It truly will. So we'll do an assessment of their work and look at the markets that will be most well-received for their work. And so we'll tailor the program specifically around to them. So we'll choose the four major art fairs that they'll go to based on the markets that are great for them. We're definitely looking at Chicago, we think is a nice fellowship market for Jacksonville residents. And they will meet with museums while they're there, other artist studios. They'll meet with art critics. They'll really get real feedback from their work, and their body of work will be assessed. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of all of that, they will be given the opportunity through a grant to be able to create a body of work that we will then go to work on finding the best place to exhibit, so that they're in a cultural capital, they're being able to build a new collector base and get new exposure.
And from your experience, this is the quickest way to build talent. So these are going to be local, regional artists, mm-hmm. but you're going to open them up to the world of art all over the world to really help them ramp up their skill set more quickly, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yep. I mean, I really believe, I mean, I've experienced it personally, but it's even more so for artists that they need to absorb new energy to be able to be filled with inspiration, to continue to reach new creative heights. It's really vital that they're given the opportunity to travel, to meet new people, and be exposed to new experiences that will create shifts in them.
It's so important. Now, this is a program for regional artists, local and regional artists. Mm-hmm. How can they apply and what are the criteria for this?
So the criteria is quite extensive. We really want to be sure that it's artists who have the strong desire to really reach new heights. So they will have to, through our website, artrepublic.com/development, they will have to upload photos of their work, essays, so we see their ability to critically write about their work, their CV, videos, all the credentials are listed on our website. So it will take them a little bit of time, but I think even that process alone will be pretty transformative for them.
ArtRepublicGlobal.com. People need to go to that website.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, casual fans of your work, which has been such a game changer for Jacksonville, if you're driving around downtown or even if you're driving along I-95, you've seen these large scale murals that you've brought to town, Jessica. Mm-hmm. You've brought in world-class artists to create those. And that's been so exciting. And there have been other events and activities involved with Art Republic, too. You're coming back for a third year in November. What's on the agenda for the fall?
So we are going to continue to cover the city and new color and art and murals. We'll be doing another 8 murals that we've already identified. And we'll also be doing an immersive art and technology event. We're really excited about the digital art piece and supporting that next movement. So that event will be November 10th.
Going to be exciting.
It is.
And in the meantime, if you think you are qualified for Jessica's new artist development program, go to artrepublicglobal.com. Learn more there. And kudos to you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. Emergency calls can escalate in unexpected ways. Is there a way callers can get the results they want when they dial 911? I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just stay tuned for music. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.